Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. We've all experienced it, those moments when you're having a conversation and all of a sudden your opposite party is no longer looking at you but staring at a screen for an email, text, or tech app. And if we're honest, we've probably been on both sides of that equation. As the amount of technology in our everyday life grows, there's a growing sense of unease by some about this growing presence and what it means to be human today. Ethicists and physicians ponder technology's effects on humanness. Psychologists and sociologists ponder our connectedness. And that makes fertile ground for writers. My guest today has written a provocative collection of speculative fiction that examines the near technological future. Alexander Weinstein's Children of the New World features stories of intuitive robots, immersive and addictive virtual reality games, memory implants of memories that never happened. Weinstein is an award-winning short story writer who's been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. He's the director of Martha's Vineyards Institute for Creative Writing, and his work has appeared in literary journals across the country. Children of the New World is published by Picador, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Alexander Weinstein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This collection of stories, Children of the New World, really engages in a lot of speculative fiction about our relationship with technology as our relationship continues to grow. How long has this been a sort of an interest of yours writing-wise?
Well, the first story in the collection, which is Saying Goodbye to Yang, that was written 10 years ago. And right around that time was when a lot of my students were getting iPhones and falling in love with their smartphones. So I think about probably right around that time, maybe a couple of years before that, I was watching to see how strange the cyberspace and the internet was making our lives.
And if anything, over the next 10 years, that relationship has grown. We're starting to see the commercials for real virtual reality on a large-scale commercial basis. Now, that story, Saying Goodbye to Yang, is really quite a poignant story. It's about a couple who have a daughter that they've adopted from China. And so they have this, it describes a world that seems to us, even today, somewhat alien. They have adopted an older brother, a robotic older brother that knows all about China. So their adopted child will have this connection to China. Can you talk about how that story came about?
Sure. My computer crashed. My laptop crashed, and it took a lot of my creative work with it. This was 10 years ago, and I felt really emotional about it, obviously, because of the loss of the work, but also because I had this computer with me in many of the places I'd lived, and so I had this attachment to the computer. And as I mentioned, right around this time, this is when my students were getting smartphones and saying they love their smartphones, and God forbid they should ever lose them. I think they would have sacrificed a distant family member before their smartphone. And so I started to realize we're having these emotional connections with our technology, and that's what then created Yang. So in many ways, Yang was my laptop.
And what was special about Yang? Tell us about this character within the story.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's a very sweet boy, even though he's a robot. He speaks robotically, right? And he's programmed to try to be human, but he isn't quite a developed model yet. And yet there's these moments where there seems to be a secret personality in him, right? He has bought a baseball glove with his allowance for no apparent reason and is collecting butterflies because he thinks they're beautiful and building this art form out of matchsticks that he really isn't programmed to know how to do. And so the question for me as the writer is really, does Yang have a soul, or is this just a glitch in the programming? Which the story doesn't answer. I mean, I personally, even though I wrote it, like to think Yang has a soul, but I may be just as fooled as all of my characters.
Yeah, and of course your character, the husband of the teller of the story, the narrator of the story, is always having to stop himself and say, oh, Yang is a robot.
Right.
And what's really interesting is you've created this world in which, and a lot of these stories also have this point where your characters are bumping into the limits of technology, although the limits are far beyond what we know now today, in which technology sort of runs our lives. In fact, in some cases, is a substitute for our lives. What a lot of these stories have in common is this sort of bump into the limit of technology. And in the case of this family, it's Did they live in a world where, yes, you could have a robotic child or robotic live-in with you, or you could have clones? And right. He draws the line at clones.
Exactly, right. Yeah, there's these sort of arbitrary distinctions people start making, right? That cloning is bad, right? That's a little too narcissistic and feels a little elitist to him that, you know, they don't want perfect kids, which is what everybody is starting to want in the society. And so robots are kind of the more organic movement there for that society.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, said these stories really began to coalesce about 10 years ago when you saw the effect of the iPhone on some of your writing students. Has this always been the main focus of your writing, or is it just one phase?
It's just really one phase. You know, before I started writing that, I really wasn't working in speculative fiction at all, right? So that moment for me was very definitive, where I then began working on this particular collection. And, of course, technology has just gotten weirder and weirder. As you're pointing out, we now soon will have virtual reality, and Pokemon Go was about as surreal as it got this summer. So there's been plenty of fodder for those kind of stories. But simultaneously, I've also been writing my second book, which is a fictional tour guide to impossible destinations. And this is much more magical realist. So there's hotels of heartbreak, for example, and museums of love. And there's a city of loneliness where you can only ever arrive alone and everyone around you is having a great time, but no one speaks to you. Right? So it's still speculative in many ways, or, you know, fantastical or imaginative fiction, but not in the same vein, this new book that I'm working on.
And were you a big consumer of speculative fiction? Arthur Clarke, Asimov, Ray Bradbury and the like?
Not really. That's what's interesting. I mean, the tradition of science fiction, I would say, where I dabbled into that in my reading, certainly Vonnegut, Kurt Vonnegut, I loved, and a little bit of Ray Bradbury, but then not so much more than that. I mean, I think the newer forms of slipstream or speculative fiction, as it's called, George Saunders, Kelly Link, Karen Russell, Stephen Milhauser, Italo Calvino, these sort of folks were the writers that I was reading the most and who I look at today. And then also some more traditional realists like James Baldwin and Tolstoy. So it's interesting that I'm writing this collection, or that I wrote this collection that definitely dives in or has a foot in science fiction, even though that wasn't my history in reading.
Hmm. As you were putting together this collection, you just found one story after another. I want to talk about a couple of stories that are sort of focusing on after the environmental apocalypse. That's Heartland and Fall Line. Heartland, just, you capture us so interesting. It's a story of a landscape guy who has found that there's no landscapes to landscape anymore because of climate change. Where he lives in Indiana, there's no more topsoil. It's all clay, and it just runs when it rains, and there's nothing left. So he puts all of his marbles on his kids becoming reality stars.
Yeah.
You begin with this sort of section where he's just banked on this child to sort of lift the family up, and the child has failed.
Yeah, it's a devastating story. It's one of the hardest stories in there in many ways, because there's so much devastation, right, for the family. I mean, they've sold off their own topsoil, and all of the houses around them are foreclosed because of essentially the banks have taken them away. And so in some ways, it's not that far from the world we live in now, right, where certainly the banking scandals and the criminal activities of the banking industry stripped homes from so many people. Right? And if you look around Michigan, where I live, you have places like Detroit that are, in some sections, more apocalyptic than this story.
Right, true.
Right? Or you go north and you've got Flint, where our governor here knowingly poisoned the family is there. So there, in many ways, the dystopia that I write about there does happen, right? It is occurring in many ways. Maybe not quite as bad, but it was what sort of triggered me, the tone of that story was the BP oil spill, where we were all just watching this oil going into the ocean. It was horrific, right? I couldn't believe the newscasts every day. And that gave this sort of desperate tone. Where in this story, of course, there's an oil spill that's just been going on for years now, right? It just seems like it'll never end. And so that was what, it was that kind of environmental catastrophe that that I was looking at and trying to create a warning story. Maybe let's not go there. Let's not keep going there.
The other story that follows in a sort of a similar line is the story Fall Line. This is a story about a one-time incredible freestyle skier. He would be in the Warren Miller videos,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, totally.
Yeah, but he's living in a world now in the Rockies where there's no snow.
Yep.
And the great powder of the Rocky Mountains is gone, and anytime it snows, it's sort of a crud, and he can't do anything with it. So he's, you know, he's living on his past. He's living in a bar.
yep.
You know, he's sort of down on his luck. But it's a wonderful story about this idea of a skier living in a world without snow.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course the other part of that too is this kind of narcissism because of these contact lenses, where you can stream. It's a sort of GoPro world that everyone lives in, where they're constantly filming everything they're doing and then automatically uploading it to get followers. And so he had all of these followers when he was a extreme skier and on the top of his game, but now he's watching it dwindle because, of course, what's he doing sitting in a bar? There's not much to tune into on these slopes anymore. And so in many ways, he's a very flawed character who is very skilled at skiing, but flawed as a human being because he's mostly just thought of himself the whole time. And that's part his fault and part the society or the technology's fault for forcing him to become such a exhibitionist.
Right. Now, this story perhaps is the closest to reality today.
Yeah, I know. It is frightening. A lot of ski places have these problems with the snowfall right now.
Right. Well with not only with the snowfall, but the fact that, you know, now we have, what, Facebook Live. We have all sorts of instant ways of videoing ourselves and putting it immediately out there.
Oh, so much.
You know, I mean, this is when you wrote this story, was that going on yet? Or was this is this more of a recent story?
That is one of the more recent stories, and I was, obviously, the selfie culture that we've moved into in the last couple of years. I mean, I think the selfie stick is really this sort of depressing flag of surrender that people are raising up around the country, around the world. And I really was looking at this notion of how much we constantly try to curate our own lives online, where you'll take a picture and then you'll spend 20 minutes putting on the filter and everything looks perfect, and then up onto Instagram or Facebook and checking how many likes you have of that photo. Or I think also Vine had come, and
right,
they kind of come and gone, but there was those Vine videos where people were following, or Periscope too, where people were following other people's lives. And it didn't really catch, thankfully, because for me it was pretty frightening technology, where people be doing laundry and talking to their followers. I just could not imagine a more Orwellian situation.
We mentioned Vine and Periscope, but I mean, now Facebook has Facebook Live and you're starting to see videos. It's gone beyond taking a selfie to more of a video experience.
Yeah, I kind of hate it when my predictions come true. They're supposed to be warnings, you know, and I joke that in about 10 years, it'll just be a nice collection of pastoral realism that I've written here, very quaint, you know, and not at all horrific. Yeah, it is bizarre to see this happening. And I think there is this pressure on us as individuals to share every detail of our lives online and to constantly look at how can we capture our lives and then broadcast it in order for what is the question, right? In some cases, it's to become a YouTube sensation, and there's this secret hope for money-making somewhere behind it. And in other cases, it's just to get friends or attention or this sort of human, very beautiful human need for contact, but also a little sad in its behind it. There seems to be a fear of loneliness to it all.
Yeah. Do you get a sense that there's about to be a backlash on technology? I mean, you know, Andrew Sullivan had this really interesting article about how I used to be a human being, and he's talking about how he became a creature of technology and sort of said, okay, I'm cutting this off.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's certainly a lot of high-profile folks who are kind of saying, enough of this.
Yeah.
And going for real human relationship, back to human relationships, reading books instead of reading, you know, blogs and, you know, iPads all day.
Yeah,
and
I love that article by Andrew Sullivan. I mean, I read it and I just said, great. I'm so happy to read somebody else talking about this. Because I do think that's going to happen. I think we're kind of in the binge drinking phase of technology right now, right? Everybody, and we can feel it. You know, if you look at how many times you check your phone, or, you know, I look at how many times I check my phone a day, it's starting to become really addictive. 20, 30, 40 times a day I'm checking, where it wasn't that long ago that maybe I would check a couple times a day.
Right.
Now it's all the time. Or you stop at a stoplight and people are sending off a last text message before the light turns green. I think it's hard. I mean, I've been saying, I think it's harder to quit than smoking at this point, to get rid of this, right, to step back. It really takes a kind of effort. And I do believe that there is a movement. We're starting to just have a kind of digital fatigue with this whole world of technology, and that we do crave these human experiences that get lost in that. Though it claims to be all about human connection, there's a way that we no longer are really connecting with people. And that's dawning on, I mean, certainly on myself and Andrew Sullivan. I see many people, you know, doing these, I'm off Facebook, I'm gone for the week, and then they come back. But there's these attempts to remove ourselves from the constant stream of information, which I see as a very good thing. I'm hoping to see more of that, and a kind of return to things like community gardens and organizations and getting together in real life rather than virtually.
My guest today is Alexander Weinstein. He's the director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and the author of a new collection of stories set in the near future, speculative fiction, Children of the New World Stories. It's published by Picador. And the title story and another one, The Cartographers, are some of the most frightening of these stories of what happens when technology runs amok. Children of the New World is about a couple who have, as we slowly sort of devise through the story, they have virtual children.
Yeah.
And what happens when a virus infects the virtual world?
Yeah, it's tragic. Again, in many ways, like the story Yang, I really feel for those kids, even though they're definitely just digital, they're just data. Right, and yet they're not data to the parents who, in real time, so to speak, even though it's virtually, they're spending all these years raising their children and loving them as parents love their kids. But then the virus hits and they have to make a dire decision about what to do, since suddenly there are these advertising spam bots and sex bots showing up. You know, these are avatars showing up to try to hawk wrinkle cream and such things in their house, and that becomes very problematic. And so, yeah, I have the same feeling, really, that those kids are real, even though they're not. And when I thought about it deeper, I mean, later, the kids are actually also advertised, like adware. They're having the parents buy things for them and take care of them. So in an insidious way, the kids might actually be really bad in a certain way because they're just marketing.
Right. The other story, The Cartographers, I think this may be the best story in the collection. It is really, and I won't give too much away because it has a wonderful switch at the end, but the story is about video virtual reality memory makers.
Yeah.
And it was, I've been watching Westworld on HBO. Sure. And again, this falls right into this sort of technology thing of, okay, don't have a real experience. Have someone create an experience for you.
Yep. And then beam it, right? So you can beam it into your head so that you remember whatever it is that you want to remember. If you had bad parents, you can remember better parents. You know, if you weren't able to have kids, you can remember having kids, whatever it may be. Or at least, if nothing else, a vacation, which is what I think the business is making the most money on, are these sort of virtual vacations and later religious experiences, because a lot of people don't want to spend the time to actually go to church or, I suppose, meditate. I don't cover the Buddhist side of that, but I'm sure that there are meditation apps and all that kind of stuff, which there are now. You know, nowadays there are actually meditation apps. So, again, spooky reality there.
Again, and there's another story that touches on that, too.
Yeah, right, right.
Moksha, which is finding enlightenment through a computer.
yeah, and that it, you know, and this, in the premise of the story is that it works. You know, you put this very clunky machinery on your head, and you get to experience enlightenment. But of course, the trick is it doesn't last, which is a kind of tongue-in-cheek commentary on the reality of the search for enlightenment, right? That even our moments of illumination are temporal. And I think in both those cases, in Moksha and the cartographers, that need or that desire to escape in some form becomes the addiction of the characters.
What I loved about the cartographers was how you went through the seven, the stages of addiction in the course of this story.
Yeah. I mean, the poor main character who just ends up beaming and spending all of his money, because, of course, then there's the high-end designer memories where they're kind of maximalist creators and every detail, possible detail of the memory is just perfect. But they cost a lot of money. He really gets addicted to that over the interactions with real people around him.
Now, as you began delving into speculative fiction, how much research did you do about all the tools that are out there? Because, I mean, you certainly wouldn't want to, I think if you're doing a speculative fiction story, you wouldn't want to write about something that's already been created or in the prototype stage, although the way technology is moving today, it may happen in of its course.
Yeah, and the fact is I don't do a great deal of research on the stories outside of my own bumbling attempts to use the new technology. Right? And then I have a 13-year-old son, so he's very connected, and he will have the new stuff and show it to me, and I'll be horrified. And then that leads to me thinking, okay, what if we take this one step further? It's almost always a question of, here's the technology of which we consider normal. For example, it's become normal to no longer call people, right, just to text them as a kind of time-saving device. And we don't realize that until we've already lost it, until it becomes sort of strange or cumbersome. Why is this person calling me? You know, why don't they just text? And then that's the absurdity. But it's a matter of trying to stay ahead of that one step, because otherwise, if you just write the realism of it, it doesn't have the critique anymore. We can't see it in many ways.
Yeah, I find that rather than walk down a hall to talk to a colleague, you text.
Oh, definitely.
You're
right.
You work on a college campus as well during the year. Would you walk across, say, the college green to visit a colleague as opposed to text, call, or email?
Yeah, right. That's commonplace not to do that walking across the college green. And if one does, all around, everybody's sort of looking down at their screens and walking around, right? Especially when Pokemon Go was in its heyday, everybody was sort of in this zombie world catching lost monsters around them.
So, walking into stuff, too.
And walking into stuff, yeah, walking off cliffs, apparently. So the absurdity of it, in many ways, we're already living absurdist fiction when we look around, right? But how to start to break out of that, as we were talking about, I think it's very important where actually taking that time to make the walk, even though you may at this point start to be seen as annoying. why is this person always showing up and talking to me, right? Why don't they just text? But I think we have to counteract the new normalcy that we find ourselves in if we want to have human relationships again, if we really want to go back to what it means to be human.
Now, I have to ask you about one last essay, which is probably the most tongue-in-cheek essay in the collection, and that is Rocket Knight.
Yeah. Another horrible school community there.
Yeah, exactly. And would you like to explain Rocket Knight?
Sure. It's, like I said, a rather horrible school community that every fall gathers together to send the least liked child into space, never to come back. And it's told in a very upbeat, sort of cheery manner. This is a nice event, all the parents gather together. And, really the only sad people are the parents of the child to be sent to space and the child himself. But nobody can even remember the kid's name anyway. So the parents and the kids and the school administrators, they all collaborate and sure enough send the kid off and gone he is from the community.
And I love the prose in there because you're mixing in like the fall harvest, the turning of the leaves, the kids have gotten to know all their classmates because those cliques, they come together so quickly. They know who the kid to go into space is. And You have all this sort of lovely PTA sort of descriptive language, and they're sending a kid into space to be rid of him.
Yeah, it's horrible, right? And this is, I mean, in many ways, it's a critique of bullying or the bullying culture, the way that we isolate certain students. And here I'm also thinking about LGBTQ students and the way that they in the past have been ostracized, and even in the present, I mean, depending on the school district, right?
Sure.
And that sort of bullying culture that where in many ways the parents and the students and the school boards do come together against the least fortunate or, you know, the most needy students sometimes. I think that's gotten better, thankfully, because of anti-bullying and all that. But that is part of the critique of that story and this sort of slapping each other on the back and feeling really good about what they're doing.
So having written all this speculative fiction about how technology, there's this one line in one of the stories in which the family, I think it was the father, who was so immersed in his own virtual reality, he actually touched his son, and he said the skin on skin was like an electric jolt because it had been so long since he actually touched his family. So a person who writes that, how are you trying to manage technology in your own life today?
I do the best I can. As I said, I find myself addicted in many ways, right, with the cell phones and the smartphones. And, of course, a lot of my work, both in teaching and in directing the Martha's Vineyard Institute and with the writing, happens on computers, right? I have a lot of emails to send. I edit my stories on the computer. So I am deeply immersed in that. And yet what I find is that I'm starting to try to create a way to step away from that. So leaving the cell phone at home and going for a bike ride, right? Which feels scary, oddly, right? I mean, it's like, you know, there's this kind of like, oh, how irresponsible of me to go out in the world without a way to contact somebody. But that's I think, the withdrawal symptoms early on. And, you know, then you actually go for the bike ride or the hike. And with my son and I, you know, certainly trying to do things in nature, trying to get out, trying to have no media time, which is difficult.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of parents have this, where you have to limit the media access, and that becomes a fight, or can become a fight. Luckily, we work it out, but there still is a way of saying, no more, we can't have the cell phones right now. Let's put them on top of the fridge and do something else.
Yeah, well, it's a great collection, Children of the New World. It's published by Picador. Alexander, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.
Alexander Weinstein speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new collection of stories is titled Children of the New World. It's published by Picador. Interestingly, even technology is not immune to technology's effects. Yesterday, Vine, the looped video site we mentioned during the interview, announced it was discontinuing the mobile app. That announcement was made on Twitter. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.